Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM Silver City, and on Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP 101.5 FM Las Cruces. This is Allison Sibick, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project. We're a nonprofit advocacy organization that promotes community health by protecting our environment and natural resources. I also serve as the director of the Gila Conservation Coalition that works to protect the free flow of the Gila and San Francisco rivers and the wilderness characteristics of the Gila and Aldo Leopold wilderness areas. In September, the Gila Conservation Coalition organized the 16th annual Gila River Festival. Given the coronavirus pandemic, the festival was online this year and offered more than 40 sessions, including panel discussions, presentations, virtual field trips, workshops, and more. The festival explored how to cultivate resilience in our communities and ecological systems as we address the crises of climate change, the coronavirus pandemic, and systemic racism. Today on Earth Matters, we're bringing to you one of this year's Gila River Festival presentations entitled Community Health, How Can We Build Resilience? With Dr. Emily Houses and Dr. Fred Fox. As the COVID-19 pandemic disproportionately hits Indigenous communities and people of color, and the calls for racial justice continue, it is no longer possible for society to look past long-standing inequities in our healthcare, economic, and cultural systems. How can we build community resilience in the face of climate change, environmental racism and injustice, and the coronavirus pandemic? Alicia Edwards, coordinator of Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities, Grant County, moderates. Let's listen.
And now I'm pleased to introduce our session speakers. We'll start with Dr. Emily Houses. Dr. Houses received her PhD from Yale University School of Nursing, where her studies focused on oncology nursing and end-of-life care. Passionate about American Indian health, Dr. Houses links Indigenous methodologies to intervention research in an effort to improve cancer outcomes in Native people. Dr. Houses is a member of the Chiricahua Fort Sill Apache tribe and is from Santa Fe, New Mexico. She will be discussing the racial, economic, and societal inequities that have allowed COVID-19 to disproportionately impact Native American communities and how Indigenous communities are responding with support, compassion, and resilience. Dr. Fred Fox is a longtime resident of Grant County. A family physician, he is medical director of a nearby Arizona County Health Department, where he is now involved in the coordinated response to the COVID-19 pandemic. He has an MS in plant ecology and continues to be interested in issues of the environment and science. He is a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the International Society of Evolutionary Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Fox will talk about how a changing climate affects human health, the emergence of new zoonotic diseases such as COVID-19, the state of public health, ecology, and the fallacy of race as a biologic construct, yet the persistence of racism. Dr. Houses, will you please start us off?
Thank you. I was yelling at my son a few minutes earlier. He likes to practice cello in the middle of all of my presentations. So it's a real pleasure to be here, and I appreciate being asked to present this morning. I wish that I was presenting on something other than health disparities and COVID-19, but that's where we are today. So I also wish I was there in person. So anyway, I'm calling in today from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I live in my office. So I'll be talking about Indian Country and COVID-19, and I'm really focusing on New Mexico here. As a lot of people know, our tribe spends our time in Oklahoma and New Mexico. I live in Santa Fe. I do most of my work here in New Mexico, so that's where we're going to be living. As stated earlier, I'm talking about the racial, economic, and societal inequities and how our communities are responding. So the inequities, let's get started with some operationalization of these terms. What are the social inequities that we're living with? Well, historically, Native American communities have been dealt a raw hand here. Not only do we have colonization, but we've had unequal access to things like voting, unequal access to education, religious freedom. We didn't have full freedom to practice our religion until the Religious Freedom, American Indian Religious Freedom Act in 1978. We've had unequal access to healthcare, even though healthcare was guaranteed through treaties, through the Indian Health Service. The Indian Health Service has been underfunded chronically since its beginnings. Economic inequities. We don't have the accumulated wealth that we see in other populations, particularly in the white population. Accumulated wealth is sort of a given. But in American Indian populations, accumulated wealth, or for those who don't understand this sort of jargon, accumulated wealth is what you have when you inherit wealth from other people from your in your family. Other populations can sort of expect that you're going to get an inheritance, but in Native American populations, we just don't have that. And it's not just because there's not a tradition of passing on, you know, property or goods, but it's because there are no goods to pass on. We have redlining in community in cities that have prevented people from buying homes. In the reservation system, the way that properties are distributed often prevents home ownership at all, so we don't have that accumulated wealth happening. There's also a lack of access to business opportunities and economic development. In reservations, the way that properties are, or the way that business is developed can be pretty convoluted, and so it's hard to get a business started. It's hard to develop your economic base, and so the accumulated wealth is just not happening. And this is a chronic problem. There's also the cultural ideas around wealth, where when you're a collective a society, we don't have the same ideas around focusing all of your wealth in one family. So in white society, it's perfectly normal for you to keep all of your money in one pot, where in Native societies, we tend to spread our money across the entire community. So if you're thinking about accumulated wealth in a community of 1,000 people or 5,000 people, that's money that's spread very, very thin. So we're just not going to see that happening. And then, of course, we have racial inequities, race-based discrimination that will result in observable differences in outcomes. So what do we have? Let's talk about these observable differences. In New Mexico, in July 2019, this is the census data that we're working with and data from the Department of Workforce Solutions. The population is about 82% white, 11% Native American and Alaska Native. And because Hispanic or Latino is an ethnicity, it's about 50% Hispanic or Latino. And those numbers don't add up because you can be both Hispanic or Latino and white or and Native American. When we look at the social determinants of health in New Mexico in July of 2019, we had, and this is really good actually, New Mexico's done very, very well with health insurance. Only 10% were without health insurance. Our unemployment rate was about 3.7%. The median home value for the general population was about $166,000, $167,000. The median household income was $52,000. And about 18% of families were living below the poverty line. We know that New Mexico is not at the top of the nation for these metrics, but that was the general population. When we look at Native Americans in 2019, the uninsured rate was 21%, unemployment was 17%, the median home value, 82,000, household income, 36, and percent of families living below the poverty line was 24.2%. So I'm going to compare those so you don't have to remember these numbers. The comparison here, you can see that Native Americans, about twice as many were without health insurance. And I want to start with a caveat here that this isn't all Native people across the state. This is, I took a selection of Native tribes in the lower half of the state. So, and I'm not going to say who, just because I don't want to like pull out anybody in particular, but this is a selection of tribes. The unemployment rate is 17% in Native populations. This is in 2019, okay? Keep that in mind. The unemployment rate, you could see, is vastly different between Natives and the general population. The home value is totally skewed. The median household income is totally skewed. And we have many more people living below the poverty line. So then COVID-19 happens. I don't have data that splits out by race here, but you can see that when we look at the data from the poverty rate is already going up in January 2020 across the state. The uninsured, we're getting more and more people to get them insured. So that's great. And we really needed that once COVID came along. But then, and this is an up-to-date number, in July 2020, the unemployment rate was 12.7. So if you remember in New Mexico last year, same time, it was what, 3.7? In July after COVID, it was 12.7. And that's in the general population. So in July of 2020, the general population had almost caught up with Native Americans at baseline. So outcomes, that's where we have these disparities. So we're seeing there's a real disparity here. And this is where when I talk about the social, economic, and racial disparities or racial inequities, that's what we have. Moving into COVID-19. So these are data as of Thursday, so the 17th. We were watching in Indian Country as Native cases just jumped up right away. And we saw, these are great numbers in New Mexico, because there was a point, an AIAN is American Indian Alaska Native. The American Indian Alaska Native cases were as much as half the cases in New Mexico. Now it's at 30.6. Keep in mind that we only have 10%, 11% of the population. So this is really striking that this much of the population in New Mexico of Native people are being infected with COVID-19. And this plays out to, so I have today's numbers. So I pulled out the paper from today. We have 27,350 cases in New Mexico. And of those, 8,424 are Native American. The other numbers here, the Hispanic numbers are high, but if you remember that about 50% of the state is Hispanic, that that does track with our state. It's the American Indian numbers that are striking and disproportionate to the population in the state. So why do we have these numbers? Besides the fact that we have just longstanding inequities, we have this chronically underfunded healthcare system in the Indian Health Service. We have serious gaps in infrastructure, parts of the state with no running water. So people are trucking in their water, so they have to really ration water so they can't keep their surfaces clean. They can't wash their hands every 5 seconds. And if you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, I remember I was just washing my hands constantly. I may not be leaving my house, but I was still washing my hands every 5 minutes. We don't have broadband internet and cell towers in many parts of the state, as you know. And we don't think about information disparity as being a health disparity, but it is, especially with COVID-19, when information was changing every day. And so when we learn more about modes of transmission and how to control the disease, as well as where to get treatment, how to get treatment, and how to protect yourself, getting information from the internet is the best way to do it. And when you don't have access to information, that is a disparity. Also, resource supply chain. This was a serious problem and is still a serious problem. It's not just the supply chain with the healthcare providers, which was, as we know, it was a problem and it still is a problem. We have difficulty in our healthcare clinics getting access to PPE, getting access to the supplies needed for COVID testing, but also supplies, just getting cleaning supplies to people, getting masks and other PPE to families who need it so that they can protect themselves. There were inequities with COVID-19 around having qualified and trained healthcare providers out in the community. With the Indian Health Service, one of the foundations of the Indian Health Service is the Commission Corps. The Commission Corps are healthcare providers who are stationed in different facilities. Very early on, we would hear the tribal leaders saying, please don't deploy our Commissioned Corps providers to other places. We need those providers here. But what happened was when we saw spikes in major urban areas, those commissioned core healthcare providers did get deployed elsewhere, which left our community clinics without qualified trained healthcare providers. And that was, again, an inequity. And then we have insufficient housing to quarantine and isolate exposed people. And this was, again, another hustle where we have families that have 10 people living in a house with 2 bedrooms or 3 bedrooms. So when you have somebody who is exposed, where are you going to put that person? So that, again, is another inequity. It's a housing inequity. And then it's an issue of trying to find places for people. Where are they going to go? So how do we respond to a pandemic? What do you do when you don't have any information, when you don't have any way to protect yourself, when you don't have tests, and you don't have any money? The tribes, one of the first things that they did was they embraced their sovereignty. Instead of following along with what everybody else was doing, they embraced their sovereignty and they recognized that they needed to do what they could for themselves. So tribal sovereignty is the right of tribal nations to govern themselves. And this is a guaranteed right in the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution recognizes tribes as distinct governments with the same powers as federal and state governments to regulate their internal affairs. So this is one of those things where we talk about Native nations as being a racial group, but in fact, we are more of a political, we have more political status than racial status. If you look at me, you might think of me as a white person. I identify as Native American, and this is why. It's because I am a tribally enrolled Native American person. We are sovereign nations, and this is where that comes from. And I think we're going to get into race and social constructs in a little bit, so I'm going to let that go for now. We can talk about that later. What else did tribes do and tribal nations? They accessed any available resources they could. They applied for CARES Act funds, which were, by the way, totally under, there weren't enough funds for Native nations, but whatever they could apply for, they did. They collaborated, so they worked with foundations and nonprofit organizations and private individuals so they could get whatever donations they could of food, masks, water, and PPE. And then there was money that people really wanted to send money to tribes. They needed the money. So one of the things that I saw was that tribes didn't have the mechanisms they needed to receive the money. They didn't have mechanisms to receive donations. And so they quickly created those mechanisms so they could receive donations. Because, you know, tribes may not have been 501c3, so they had to quickly find a way to receive donations so that private donors could get the tax benefits from making those donations. The next thing they did was they locked down their borders. This is something that tribes could do. You know, small communities, small towns can't necessarily close their borders, but tribes can because of that sovereignty. They close the reservation borders, and then they can really control the spread of the virus in and out. They instituted curfews to help control the population from moving from home to home. And then the next thing they did was they created food distribution events so that people in the communities didn't leave during the day and come back and, you know, they go to Walmart and they get exposed from everybody who's in like Rio Rancho or wherever, or Las Cruces, and then they come back. And by having these food distribution events where people could come and they would get bags of food put in the back of their car, the back of their truck, it would regulate the flow of traffic in and out of the community, and it would also regulate how much contact people had with each other. And then they engaged experts. So they collaborated with experts in infection control, and they did their own contact tracing. They worked to create their own evidence-based infection management. They developed isolation protocols, and tribes established their own incident command centers so that they could really manage the COVID-19 within their own borders. And then they partnered with each other so they could share resources when possible. Each tribe couldn't open its own hotel. And if you remember, all of the tribes in New Mexico closed their casinos like instantly because they saw that that was a very easy mode of transmission. And they closed their hotels. And then they saw they needed a place for people to be isolated. So a few of the hotels opened and became homes for isolation for tribal members from all of the regional tribes. And so that was a shared resource. They also would share testing sites so they could have community testing events and do population-based testing, which is a proven strategy for controlling infectious disease. And they also have regular calls, which they're continuing now, so they can compare strategies. And this is a great way of partnering and sharing knowledge and also sharing support. And then they maintain. They are staying the course. We all talk about pandemic fatigue. This is a recognized problem. So they are continuing to support community wellness until the threat is passed. There is just constant vigilance against misinformation, continued support within and across tribal communities. And there is a lot of recognition that this is really hard. It has been hard. It's going to continue to be hard, and they have to stay the course. And this is how we talk about resilience, because in this case, as with many of the threats that we've had in our native nations, resilience comes from resistance. We have to resist. We have to continue to embrace and be aware of our sovereignty and use our sovereignty as a tool to control the virus. That is how we do it.
That was great. Thank you very much for sharing that story. Really great. Dr. Houses, can you tell us how are things looking right now for the tribal communities? I know there for a while it was really terrifying. Are things better?
Things are better. We're having fewer and fewer deaths, which is always a positive. And the cases are being managed very well. And it has been about staying the course. We still have curfews. We still have closed borders. And people are getting really tired of that. But that has proven to be effective.
All right. Thank you. So today I'm going to be talking about zoonoses and our distressed planet and the increasing risk for peoples of the world. I want to thank Alicia, you, and you, Emily, and also Donna Stevens and the Gila River Festival for this opportunity. And also, I'm at the Western Institute of Lifelong Learning office, so that I have some adequate internet. And I want to thank Susan Beck, who you just saw helping me. So today, I'm going to define zoonoses. The zoonotic infections, explain the modes of transmission, and provide some examples. And then I'm going to relate the occurrence of the increasing occurrence of zoonotic disease to the worldwide and widespread destruction of natural environments and disruption of the entire ecosystems. I'll discuss and denote that disadvantaged and impoverished communities suffer its disproportionate effect. And finally, that the burden is not due to race, which is a fallacy, but rather to racism itself. So what exactly is zoonotic diseases? Well, they're infectious diseases. They're caused by pathogens that cross from an animal reservoir or host, oftentimes through an intermediary or directly, to humans. Those pathogens can be viruses, bacteria, fungi, parasites, or prions. Now, prions you may not be aware of. They are misfolded proteins. They're not actually living, but they can be communicated and infect and cause other proteins in the infected person to misfold. Samples of this are mad cow disease and also chronic wasting disease of deer and elk. They're almost invariably fatal neurologic diseases. Typically, the first infected individual of a zoonotic infection then transmits the disease to another in a person-to-person chain. But it can occur that they also are not transmitted further. This occurred most recently in the bird flu outbreaks that occurred back in 96, the H5N1, where there was high mortality in poultry workers, but they weren't transmitted to other people easily. COVID-19 is a zoonotic infection, and it's arguably the worst pandemic we've experienced since the 1918 Spanish flu and influenza. So just how common are zoonotic illnesses? If you look at all human infections, 60% of them are zoonotic in origin. And if you look only at those that are new and emerging infections, 3/4 of those are. So how are these illnesses transmitted? Well, it can occur in several ways and sometimes a combination. Petting or touching an animal or being bitten or scratched are examples of direct transmission. Rabies is an example of this, or some of the skin fungal infections. Contaminated habitats, such as water, soil, barns, even feeding dishes, or the infectious particles drying and being bitten into the air are indirect methods, and hantavirus is an example of this. We're probably most of us aware of vector-borne transmission. This is where the host animal transmit the disease to humans through an intermediary organism. Those can be rodents, fleas, ticks, mosquitoes. And finally, foodborne illnesses, infections can occur when unpasteurized or undercooked food, such as meat, dairy, poultry, eggs, fruit, and vegetables that are contaminated with the animal feces are passed on. The pathogenic E. coli and salmonella outbreaks and food recalls are examples of this. So how are these zoonotic infections related to our environment? Well, we know that unstable, disturbed ecosystems that are a result of human-caused disruption, degradation, and destruction of the natural environment dramatically increase the conditions that are conducive to these pathogens being transferred and to also to the interactions between the host animals and people that allow the transfer of these diseases. So I'd like to discuss some examples. I'm going to talk about tropical rainforests first in a little bit of detail. They are being degraded by a number of means. One is increase in ambient temperature through global warming. This has the effect of increasing the transpiration, the loss of water through the plant leaves, which brings water up through the root system of the soil and results in more water stress for that plant. Also, the temperature increase changes the actual physiological or metabolic processes of the plant. The sum total of this is that some plant species are able to make it and some aren't. So even in the surviving forest, the species makeup changes. Increased drought also occurs through climate change. Tropical rainforests typically have wet and dry seasons, and the balance of this and the severity of each is disrupted. That also alters species composition. Deforestation, which we all are familiar with to some degree, this is where clear cutting occurs either for grazing commonly or for agriculture in timber, where plant monoculture plantations for rubber, bananas, palm oil are put in place. Just 2 weeks ago in Science Magazine, there was a large study where they reported where instead of just the visible deforestation that we see from satellite imaging, underneath that plant canopy, there's marked disruption going on from selective thinning, from grazing, from small-scale agriculture, roads, and other man-made disruptions. And this, oftentimes this forest degradation can exceed the actual deforestation. There's tremendous nutrient loss. Most of the nutrients in forests and in tropical forests is present in the actual biomass above ground. When this is removed, the nutrients are lost. Others are lost through soil and water erosion. In grasslands, however, much of that nutrient is present in the deep, well-developed soils, and that, of course, has been lost in those circumstances. Animal health deteriorates as a result, and there's more intrinsic disease present, and there's greater likelihood of the spread of that disease to humans. The human and animal contact increases. So when subsistence hunting occurs, the so-called bushmeat occurs, there's more chance for exposure to these zoonotic diseases. There's also incursions of wild animals into human habitated areas, such as occurred with chimpanzees in disturbed areas in Africa, where there have even been young children and infants killed for food by the chimpanzees, and also the incursion of the macaques in the Fukushima damaged communities in Japan. And in August, just last month in August in an article in Nature. They reported on a large study looking at over 7,000 ecological assemblages. And they found that in disturbed areas, there was an increased proportion and absolute number of those species of animals capable of transmitting diseases to humans. And finally, there's an increase in the invertebrate, insect, and rodent vectors that are capable of transmitting pathogens. This is a satellite image of Western Brazil. This is an area of two areas showing a river. There was a road that roughly went north to south in 1975. The area here is a roughly 500,000 acres. So it might be equivalent to the Gila Wilderness area on the west side of the road up in Alto Leopold. A little over 30 years later, there's urban areas, and you see the lateral lines where roads coming in from the main road have now had deforestation occur on either side. And as I pointed out, even the remaining forest has been significantly degraded. There's also disruption from land used by agriculture. The widespread conversion of natural areas to agricultural land has been undergone in the last 50 years, especially for production of food. This has especially been true in terms of meat production, livestock production, primarily cattle, pigs, and poultry, because of the increased demand for animal protein. In these crowded conditions, it's possible for animal infections to increase and for these illnesses to jump to humans. An interesting thing is that pigs can become an influenza mixing bowl, if you will. Most animals or types of animals have one species of flu or one strain of flu that they catch. So there's bird flus, human flus, other animals, and pig. But swine can catch not only human and bird flus, or can catch human and bird flus in addition to their own. These viruses can then exchange genetic material, reassort to create a new novel flu strain to which we don't have any innate immunity. This is what occurred in the 2009 swine flu H1N1 epidemic. This is a major public health concern and worry, because if new reassortment occurs that takes a little bit into the recipe of a very virulent form and easily transmissible, that could cause quite significant problems for us. There are this is an example of just what some of these large industrial scale agriculture and animal agricultural areas look like. And you can see how easy it is for disease to spread between the animals and then become, in turn, jump to people. So there are already a lot of zoonotic infections that we currently experience. There's well over 1,000. Some made the jump in the past and are now ours, and other zoonoses continue to cause illness by expanding to new areas and new populations. Let's talk about some examples. Human immunodeficiency viruses, or HIV and AIDS, this is actually jumped to humans about 100 years ago, and it did that twice. It jumped from the simian immunodeficiency virus that infected primates to humans, most probably from hunting activities, where the hunters were exposed to the carcasses and blood and picked up the infections that way. They continued to evolve into what's now a human disease, HIV. 35 million people have already died from HIV, and 750,000 continue to evolve each year. Another example that crossed over in the past are tuberculosis. This probably occurred tens of thousands of years ago in some of our ancestors and may have jumped from some unknown ungulate. That disease continued to evolve, and now it's a human illness. About 1,500 years ago, measles developed. It came crossed over from rinderpest, which is a viral disease of cattle, and has since evolved into our modern-day measles. In the meantime, rinderpest has mostly been eliminated in cattle. There are other current zoonotic infections that you're aware of. There's plague, hantavirus, malaria, Giardia, rabies, dengue fever, chikungunya, and Zika. These last three have been expanding, even crossing oceans, carried by a mosquito vector. Lyme disease, West Nile, and Ebola. And then, of course, COVID-19. It's a coronavirus, and there's several coronaviruses that cause a common cold. But this one that we're experiencing now probably arose from bats sometime in the last 50 years, based on the genetic studies, not clear exactly when, and probably went through intermediate animal hosts before it jumped to us. That's still unclear. Zoonotic illnesses will remain a major public health burden worldwide. And in addition, novel and new infections will continue to break through and become more common. And it's likely we'll experience some that are even more lethal than the ones we've experienced already. So a growing realization is that increasing disruption and disturbance of our entire biosphere through the global warming, extinction of species and loss of diversity, destruction of land and ocean habitats, industrialization and expansion of agriculture, urbanization, release of toxins and pollution, climate change, and of course our continued human population growth, which has grown from about 4 million to almost 8 million in the last 50 years, is creating a catastrophe on our environmental, ecological, and human systems. Recently, a large collaborative United Nations assessment, 2019, noted the unprecedented extinction of existing species and loss of biodiversity, and that this has grave consequences to continued human existence. This year, this summer, the UN released 10 key policy points concerning the increasing risk of these zoonotic diseases and the increased likelihood of future pandemics. And they're related to the disturbance of natural systems as being the drivers, as we've already alluded to. Both documents also note that the greatest burden of these changing environmental conditions and the zoonotic infections are borne by poor people and people of indigenous populations. Just today, or last night when I got back, I saw this article out of Science. And the title is Ecological and Evolutionary Consequence of Systemic Racism in Urban Environments. And it talks about that in an urban environment, which we don't think of as ecosystems really, but they are, that the review article looked at that the impact of COVID-19 and other zoonotic diseases is far greater in those areas that have been redlined, as Emily alluded to, on the basis of race and racism. So who is impacted? So although all human communities suffer the effects of environmental degradation and ecological instability and zoonotic disease, it's indigenous and subsistence people, disadvantaged persons, and others who live in poverty who often reside in those areas that are most affected by environmental disruption, and they will be the ones disproportionately impacted. It is not race that makes them more susceptible. It's racism that's a common denominator and causal factor. So what about this concept of race? I could go on for an hour about this, and I'm only going to summarize a couple things. The idea of biological race is a fallacy. It's not supported by scientific or genetic studies. Race is instead a social designation, but that's changed throughout our history, as designations of what races were. And it's purely a designation when it's applied to someone based on skin pigmentation. But all humans are descended from our African ancestors, and those ancestors have been found exhibit a wide variation in pigmentation genes. And most of us retain those genes for that pigmentation. Skin color that exists in the world is in a wide variety of skin tone are regulated by a complex of modifying traits that bear no relationship being clumped together into races. This is a picture from the Smithsonian just showing some of the variations in pigmentation. Where do you divide that up into races based on skin color? Yet race does have some value. persons who self-identify as members of a race may find value and confirmation in doing this, may find have a pride in historic and contemporary accomplishments, may have a knowledge of collective history. An inclusion in the shared experience and family and cultural narrative and support in the struggle against racism. And these may be possible benefits to those individuals who do so. So this disparity in biological outcome of COVID-19 disease, as Emily alluded to, that occur in communities of color, occur not because there's any significant genetic difference there, but it's rather due to the social determinants of poverty, of food insecurity, of local environmental exposure and toxicities, of the stress of racism, of the directed violence, of underemployment and the lack of medical care and facilities. These are not on the basis of race, they're the result of racism. Yet all of us have been raised in a racialized society and we've acquired some degree of inherent bias, and we need to be aware of this and address it ourselves. But it's important that as we address environmental issues, and that we, part of that has to be the awareness of racism and the role it plays. Thank you very much.
Let's listen now to the question and answer session.
We have quite a few questions lined up in the queue here, and I would encourage other people who are thinking about this topic to submit their questions. The first one is for Emily. Emily, can you talk about the cultural perspectives that discourage Native Americans from trusting the medical industry?
That's a really interesting question. The medical industry, well, the cultural perspectives. I would say that it's less about cultural perspectives and it's more about, as I discussed earlier, the chronic underfunding has created a dynamic in which the healthcare system that is designed to provide care for American Indians and Alaska Natives is insufficient. And when you rely on an insufficient healthcare system, it doesn't matter who it is, if your healthcare system is insufficient and is not delivering what it promises, you're not going to trust it. And it doesn't matter who you are or what culture you come from. That's a sort of the foundation of that mistrust. Then when you layer on top of that a history of actual unethical treatment, where we have medical testing that has happened without people's consent or even knowledge. There is well-documented examples of really unethical medical treatment and testing that has happened in American Indian populations that adds to that mistrust. There's also actual racist care that happens where people feel discriminated against when they go to receive their care, that adds to that mistrust. So it's not really cultural, it's experiential. And then there is the history that we have of forced sterilization. And that started, we don't know how far back it started. It ended in the 1970s. So that is a recent history. And those forced sterilizations happened without women's knowledge or consent. And so that is another layer that adds to that mistrust. And so those all are elements that discourage Native Americans from trusting the medical industry. And there's also the situation where, because it's underfunded, we have people who go and they have poor health outcomes. And I've had this experience where, because I've done work with American Indians with cancer, they will be in the cancer clinic in the chemotherapy suite, and they're sitting there. Women will have breast cancer, and they're talking with other women, with white women, and they'll say, "Well, I have this breast cancer." And then the woman next to them, who's not Native, will say, "Well, I have breast cancer." And the Native woman will say, "Well, they're expecting that I'm going to die." And the white woman will say, "Well, no, I'm not going to die. I expect to live." And the Native women will say, "Well, that's really that doesn't make any sense to me. And so they are seeing these disparities in outcomes in their own lives, and they see that it's just plain old not fair. And there are a whole lot of reasons why Native women have poor outcomes. They're seeing it in their communities. They're seeing it in their own bodies. And that adds to that mistrust.
Wow.
Yeah.
The next question is, Emily, I'm so sorry to hear you had COVID-19. What was your experience like with that?
Well, thank you. Okay. In March, our family went on vacation to New York City. This was before we really knew what was happening with COVID-19. This is when everybody said, oh, it's just like the flu. And this is before we even knew how many people already were walking around with COVID-19. We went to New York City. We would have canceled our trip, except that we had a lot of tickets to go see Broadway shows, and our family really likes Broadway. And they were non-refundable tickets. So we went to one show. I saw Hamilton live, and the woman sitting behind me was coughing the whole time. All of the other shows were canceled. We left the very next day. We cut our trip short because everything just shut down. We came home. I got sick a few days later. My husband also got sick. It was very difficult to get tested. It was very difficult to get anything. This was at the point in time when you had to have direct contact with a confirmed case, or you had to have been to China. And so we really had to fight to even get tested. I was very pleased, actually, because the one person who would listen to me was the doctor at the Indian Health Service, and she really advocated for me and got me tested. And I ended up being sick for a number of weeks. I went to the emergency room. It was really pretty awful, and I still have long-term effects. So that was March. Now it's September, and I typically spend my weekends just laying on the couch watching TV. I don't have the stamina that I had before. You know, my big accomplishment last week was I went for a 2-mile hike. Well, it wasn't even a hike. It was a casual walk. It's a rotten disease. I really recommend everybody, you stay home. You don't go out. You really, like I was saying before, stay the course. Yeah, wear a mask and don't get it if you can prevent it, because you don't know if you're going to be the one. And if you are the one, it's rotten. And I got lucky that I wasn't in the hospital. I wasn't on a respirator. I had a mild case.
The next question is for Fred. Are vegetarians or vegans less likely to experience these problems or illnesses?
I've not seen any direct research about that. The one thing that might apply is that a lot of vegetarians are very health oriented. And so in general, they're going to have fewer problems such as the obesity and diabetes, other metabolic diseases that increase the likelihood they'll do badly if they get COVID. Zoonotic infections in general, I can't really say if that's true or not.
The next question is, Fred, why are zoonotic illnesses increasingly becoming more common?
Well, it's really multifaceted. Part of it is ultimately it's the impact that we as humans have had on our environment. And that we've disrupted so much of the Earth's surface and so much of the biomes and ecosystems that the normal sort of ecological stability and processes no longer exist. And so that the barrier between animal hosts for illnesses and us as humans has degraded. It's also true that climate change and other things along with this have made conditions more conducive for vectors to increase. One of the things about the article that I talked about yesterday, or this that I read yesterday, is that in urban areas, the degraded areas that are the results of redlining have more rodent populations and other populations that can transmit zoonotic infections. But another reason why zoonotic illnesses are becoming more common is it simply there's more of us and we travel more, and there's a lot more. Just as Emily noted, you go to a city and you pick it up. People, animal products are transmitted across international borders.
All right, next question. Fred, what links between these concerns and climate change have you seen from the UN or the WHO?
Well, they've all been in the last 2019, I mentioned the one policy paper. They put out several policy papers looking at the effects of environmental degradation, the impact on species diversity, or the loss that that richness gives in terms of protecting us from some of these things, and the increase of zoonotic diseases and the increased threat that this represents, and that this will be an increased threat. So they've come out with some policy recommendations about that. There have been additional ones. This one, the 2020, came out last month. Living Planet Report from the World Wildlife Fund talks about ways that the world needs to urgently address and change how we look at things. There was an article in Nature magazine talking about that here this last month, talking about how to bend the curve of terrestrial biodiversity, so that a number of big organizations and big research projects are now addressing this. But we are at a critical time in our lives as human beings. If we don't dramatically change this, we're in big trouble. There was a quote, two quotes. One is by actually Michael Collins, who is the command module pilot on Apollo 11, who circled the moon while his two buddies were walking on the surface. A few years ago, he said, after thinking about all this for years, is we need, and other people have said the same thing, we need to ensure prosperity without growth, because it's this continued growth and the way we've just continued to disrupt things that has put us in this bad problem. And there's another by, I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the journalist, who said, before you realize what's gone on with environmental disruption, you have 1,000 problems. But it's like when you find you get a diagnosis of cancer, then you have one problem. And if you look at what's going on in our world, we have one problem. Now, there's many ways we have to deal with it. We have to address racism. We have to address the inequality that exists, and many of the, and all the other things, but we have one huge problem.
Well said. So we're at the end of our time, and I would just like to say that this has really been fascinating, and I think the hearing about the really scientific thing in the context of what is happening with humans has been very, very powerful. I really, really appreciate, I can't think of the word I want, but, you know, the difference between hearing the two side by side for me has been absolutely fantastic and very thought provoking. So Dr. Houses and Dr. Fox, thank you so very much for being here today. Really, really appreciate you sharing your very human stories and your very your incredible scientific expertise. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us. Appreciate
it. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you a lot. Thank you all for listening.
We just heard a presentation from the 16th Annual Gila River Festival on Community Health and Resilience with Dr. Emily Houses and Dr. Fred Fox. Thanks to support from the New Mexico Humanities Council, all festival presentations are available for free on the Gila Conservation Coalition Vimeo channel at vimeo.com/showcase/Gila River Festival. Thank you for joining us today on Earth Matters. A podcast of today's show and past programs are available in the Earth Matters archive at gmcr.org. Thank you to our audio engineers, Marcus Hansen and Michael Allen. Join us next week for another episode of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, 89.1 FM Silver City, and KTEL LP, 101.5 FM Las Cruces.